Thank you so much for being here and coming to this pre-concert lecture of what I hope is going to be a really wonderful event. Today I'll be speaking about the kinds of obstacles that women who wanted to become composers faced in the 19th century and the early 20th century. These obstacles started with their difficulty in becoming musicians at all. So I will start there. I'll end with spending some time on the life and career of Dame Ethel Smyth, whose musical talent and indomitable personality led to her remarkable success. I do have some slides this evening. They are a little bit dark, so I'll do my best to tell you what you're missing. When we think about women in history, we often think of them stuck at home, running a household, raising children, rather than having a career. Women sang, but in the 19th century, they were restricted to particular musical instruments, typically those that they could play by themselves, so something that made chords like a piano or a harp, something that you could entertain yourself or your family with. Now, if you've read the novels of Jane Austen or seen the countless movie adaptations, you know that almost every good heroine plays the piano. This was part of the skill set of a middle or upper class woman. And at some point, it might occur to you, if all of those young ladies were whiling away their free hours practicing, surely some of them got very good at it? And of course, you'd be correct. However, when performing as an amateur, women were pressured not to overshadow men. An 1851 article in an American magazine instructed women to practice in private music far more difficult than you play in general society. So if you were good, you weren't supposed to show it. Nonetheless, there were successful professional women pianists in the 19th century. The French pianist Marie Pleyel, the British pianist Arabella Goddard, and the most famous one of all, the Venezuelan Teresa Carreño. However, reviews of female pianists might discuss their dress or their looks rather than their playing. And since the image of a piano virtuoso was male, a woman who could play the piano very well and had that kind of physical strength, this might suggest that she was either unnatural or showing off in an unwomanly fashion. Male virtuosi were supposed to improvise, and they were also supposed to play their own compositions. Most women weren't trained to do that, so they had to play pieces by men. Even when women became professional musicians, societal expectations ended many performers' careers. Now, you may not be able to see this very well, but that's Marie Krebs. She was a piano prodigy. She made her debut at the age of 11. And that very dark program is the program of the London Philharmonic in 1884, where she was playing Beethoven's Third Piano Concerto. But the history of the London Philharmonic tells us that that was her final performance, because she married and therefore had to retire at the age of 33. In the late 19th century, it became more common for women to play the violin. But the place that violinists typically play the violin is an orchestra, and women were prevented from joining orchestras. When girls were part of a school orchestra in Berlin in 1881, the director asked that they be removed because their playing was weak and they lowered the artistic level, and they chattered too much and distracted the male students. So I don't know if you can see that white figure in the middle of the Buffalo Orchestra in 1881, but that's the single woman in that orchestra. And this photo is highly unusual. I've never seen anything like it. Most period pictures of orchestras are always men. So, if you were a woman and you played the violin, where would you play? You would play in a woman's orchestra. In England, there were some aristocratic amateur women who made up string orchestras. In America, the Boston Fadettes lasted over 30 years. It was a professional women's orchestra. In the 20th century, the Chicago Women's Symphony Orchestra lasted for several decades. It took until the 1970s and 80s for American orchestras to have larger portions of women after auditions began to be held behind screens so judges could not see the player's gender. That's 1970s and 80s, not 1870s and 80s. When it came to women becoming professional composers, they were hampered by a lack of education. They typically could only get the education that they would receive privately. Conservatories did open up to women in the 19th century, but women were often on separate tracks from the men, educated separately. It was assumed they had no compositional ability and they would not be composers. So they did not get advanced music theory classes. They did not get orchestration classes, the technical tools that would allow them to be composers. Even if they did compose, they often didn't have access to the male world of conductors, ensembles, or publishers that could play or promote their music. Virginia Woolf famously said that a woman writer needs a room of her own. Well, a woman composer needs not only a room of her own, she needs an orchestra of her own, or an opera company of her own. Far more difficult to get than just a room. Women often then composed pieces that were small, songs, piano solos, that they could play in that room at home. However, there were women composers, and these women typically came from families that were already made up of professional musicians, and they came from the middle classes. They were not wealthy. So music is what supported their families, and it made sense for them to go into the family business. So class, as much as gender, shaped their careers. They often combined composition with the other activities in their lives. Clara Schumann is the best example. She came from a musical family. Her father was a piano pedagogue. Her mother was a singer. Her father trained her to be a piano virtuoso. And because piano virtuosos compose, he also trained her to compose. By the time she was a teenager, she was having an international career before she married that guy, Robert Schumann. In contrast, Fanny Mendelssohn Hensel came from one of the wealthiest families in Berlin. Her parents weren't even sure that their son Felix ought to go into music. There was no way that their upper-class daughter would. It was simply unthinkable for her to lower herself in that way. By the late 19th century, there were many successful female composers, many of whom had international reputations. French composer Cécile Chaminade was so well known that her image could be found on cigarette cards, which were like baseball cards, but they came in packages of cigarettes. American women were so taken with Chaminade that they named their music clubs after her. And you can't really see all those little dots on the map that my doctoral student, Michelle Eichley, made, but they are the dots all over America where there were Chaminade clubs, 65 of them at least, and a few of them still exist. We sometimes believe that women were lost to history. Maybe men lost women to history. But I'm happy to report that historically, women have often paid a lot of attention to the efforts of women composers. And I'll give you just a few examples. If you came to the concert last night, maybe you thought, wow, this is an unusual, a whole evening of music by women. Well, in 1906, the General Federation of Women's Clubs put on a whole evening of music by women composers at their national meeting in a space that held 3,000 people. In 1920, a woman named Linda Wardwell from Connecticut published a little book about American composers that women could take to their music club meetings. They could stuff it into their purse. There were about 120 composers in this book, and a fourth of them were women. On the left is a program from the Women's Club of Esterville, Iowa, from 1904. Esterville, Iowa is north in the state. And in 1904, the Women's Club decided they would have a program on women composers. And this program lists Cecile Chaminade, Fanny Mendelssohn, and Clara Schumann. The program on the right is a program from the faculty women's group at Ames, probably the wives of the male faculty. They're having a program on British composers. And there's the name of Ethel Smyth, who we'll be hearing from this evening. Now, if thankfully you can't see these slides, because all of these women's names are spelled wrong. So obviously in Iowa, we have a spelling or typo problem, but we do know from the beginning of the 20th century, our women composers. At the turn of the 20th century, women were producing small pieces in great numbers. The musicologist Chris Reynolds, many years ago, decided he would, just for fun, start collecting songs by women. So when he would wander into an antique store, he would pick up some sheet music. He thought this would be a fun little hobby. Then eBay happened, and he got kind of serious about his hobby. And by the time he was done, he had 20,000 English language songs by British and American composers published between 1890 and 1930. So you might think, well, 20,000 songs, women have arrived. But to write a little song is not good enough to be a real composer. The British critic J. Fuller Maitland said that he was skeptical of women's amount of creative skill. He said, to write charming songs and to get them sung everywhere is not to attain the place of a composer. And only rarely have women gone beyond this. I'd really like J. Fuller Maitland to meet Taylor Swift. But if you were a composer who wrote music in large forms, symphonies, operas, you had to be unwomanly. The American composer Amy Beach wrote a really wonderful symphony in 1897. It got played by every major American orchestra. The critics could not get over the fact that it was composed by a woman. Here's the critic. The symphony of Mrs. Beach is too long, too strenuously worked over, and attempts too much. In its efforts to be masculine, it ends in being monotonous and spasmodic. Of grace and delicacy, there are evidences in the Siciliana, but there she is at her best, but yet a woman. So it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. Given this context, the attitudes and the accomplishments of the British composer Ethel Smyth were extraordinary. As a young woman, she was determined to study music at the best school in Europe, the Leipzig Conservatory. Her conservative military father disagreed, saying that he would sooner see her under the sod. Smythe waged war. She ran off to London to see concerts, and when she was at home, she refused to come out of her room for days at a time. Her father even had to kick in the door at one point. When she was 19, he finally relented. Off she went to Leipzig, where she studied for a while, and then found that the conservatory was not up to her standards. So she studied privately. She also became well known in leading musical circles. One admirer described her meteor-like appearance and that she was altogether electrifying. Smythe knew Clara Schumann, Edvard Grieg, and Johannes Brahms. Johannes Brahms once complimented her music when he didn't know it was by her. He also hated parties and one time showed an insulting poem that Ethel had written about him to dinner guests. Early on, Ethel said, marriage and children were something that prevented women from being composers. She was not interested. She was once engaged to Oscar Wilde's younger brother, William, very briefly. She met him on a trip to Ireland. They were floating together on a boat, romantically under the stars, discussing the relative merits of various philosophers, when Ethel became seasick all over William. He was madly in love with her. The engagement lasted about 3 weeks. Although Smythe was fearless in breaking gender barriers, she still faced the old boy musical network, which she referred to as the machine. When she tried to publish her songs, the publisher who rejected her said that no woman had ever been successful in composing, except for maybe a few little songs by Clara Schumann and Fanny Mendelssohn. For Smythe, the wide network of her female friends and her female lovers assisted in getting her works performed and contributed to her professional success. Smythe called women's friendships the shining threads in my life. Smythe was also a dog lover. She took her first dog, Marco, who's the one on the left, to rehearsals with her. When the composer Tchaikovsky wrote to her, he made sure to send his best wishes to Marco as well. After a decade, Smythe returned to England. Her composing included chamber music, choral music, songs, but she was most drawn to composing operas. And all six of her operas were staged during her lifetime. Her success in the genre led one critic to describe how she blew to blazes the idea that women couldn't compose. Smythe was the first woman to have an opera performed at the Metropolitan Opera House in 1903. It took over a century for the next opera by a woman to be heard there in 2016. Ethel's opera, Der Wald, received a 10-minute ovation during which she had to take 7 curtain calls. The press said that she received enough flowers to outfit a florist's shop. But critics described the work's vigor and masculinity and said that it lacked feminine emotion, such that no one could recognize it was from the mind of a woman. Not sure if that's a compliment or an insult. And of course, the New York Times, in a column called Gowns of All Sorts, made sure to tell people that her dress was black silk and that she had pink flowers in her hair. The opera by Smythe that has recently begun to be restaged is The Wreckers. It's an opera about a religious group off the Cornish coast that lives by looting shipwrecks. And the pair of lovers that are killed by the community for opposing this immoral practice. The first performance of The Wreckers took place in Germany in 1906. Smythe had been trying to get it produced for 2 years, and the first performance went very well. But she was angry that the conductor made cuts to the third act. So she went into the orchestra pit, removed the orchestra player's parts and the full score, and left town. And there were no more performances of The Wreckers with cuts in Germany. In 1910, Smythe heard the suffragette, Emmeline Pankhurst, speak. She found her an even more astonishing figure than Joan of Arc. She was deeply moved and after a couple of weeks decided that she would quit composing for a few years and work for suffrage with the Women's Social and Political Union. Smythe composed The March of the Women to serve as the theme song for the movement. But her contributions were not just musical. On the golf course next to her cottage in Surrey, she taught Pankhurst how to throw a stone that could hit its target. She and Pankhurst were imprisoned in adjacent cells in Holloway Prison in 1912. One cabinet minister had made what Smythe found to be a sexist and insulting comment, so she broke his window. The conductor, Thomas Beecham, said that sending Smythe to prison, he visited her there, had not changed her attitude. She neither reflected nor repented. And the story goes that as the suffragettes marched around the prison yard singing the March of the Women, Smythe conducted out the window of her prison cell with a toothbrush. In 1930, Smythe, wearing the gowns of one of her honorary doctorates, conducted a police band performing the March of the Women at the dedication of the statue of Pankhurst 2 years after the Equal Franchise Act was passed. Around World War I, Ethel realized that she was going deaf, and eventually this ended her compositional career. She instead began writing, producing 11 mostly autobiographical books. Given her experience in the suffrage movement, she was aware of women's political positions, and she wrote in favor of women's right to play in professional orchestras. She wanted women in the arts to know how it had been for her, and that they were not alone on the road that they had been traveling. She quipped that she had been taught it was bad manners to talk about herself, but she found the subject matter so absorbing that she couldn't do that. Although Smythe was open about her relationships with women, given the times in which she lived, she was not completely forthcoming about all of her affairs. By our standards, where everything ends up on Instagram, she was maybe even a little Victorian. But she did have one major relationship with a man, and that was Henry Brewster, who wrote the texts for her operas as well. So he was artistically extremely important for her. Smythe was passionate about her relationships, as passionate as she was about her music. She was also similarly demanding and uncompromising, so her relationships could be tempestuous and even a little overwhelming for those involved. This was initially the case when Smythe became involved with Virginia Woolf late in life. The writer gave her the nickname Uncastrated Cat. She wrote, "An old woman has fallen in love with me. It is like being caught by a giant crab." Smythe first sought out Woolf in 1930 because she had read Woolf's A Room of One's Own. Woolf knew who she was. She had seen the Wreckers. She had even reviewed some of Smythe's books. And she found that she had more candor than literary ability, saying, "It's a pity she can't write, but it fascinates me all the same." Two women who had both had to achieve their success in fields dominated by men had a lot to talk about. A week after they met, Woolf wrote to Smythe and said, "I want to talk and talk and talk." Yet when they became close, Woolf found them to be opposite in character. "How we differ. Our minds are too entirely and integrally different, which is why we get on." Smythe characteristically said she had never cared for anyone more profoundly than Virginia. Woolf particularly encouraged Smythe's writing. She prided herself on being the person that kept Ethel at it. She said, "Why don't you be not only the first woman to write an opera, but equally the first to tell the truths about herself? Isn't the great artist the only person to tell the truth?" Now, Wolfe was mistaken. Ethel was not the first woman to write an opera by a long shot, but Wolfe knew she didn't know that much about music. She said if she commented on music, it would be like a deaf monkey criticizing Mozart. When it came to Smythe's writing, Wolfe gave her sort of contradictory advice. She requested that Smythe provide analysis of her sex life and concentrate on her lesbianism. At the same time, she also said that when you were writing, advocating for women, you should leave yourself out of it so it didn't look like you were just pleading for yourself. She joked that Smythe's books could be named Me One, Me Two, Me Three, etc. She was going to put, Smythe was going to put Wolfe in her book, Female Pipings in Eden in 1933, but Wolfe apparently made so many suggestions for edits that she was left out of the book. In 1931, the two women gave a joint presentation on music and literature for the meeting of the London and National Society for Women's Service. And in this talk, which I would have loved to have heard, Wolfe acknowledged that female composers had had a more difficult time than female writers. Women were not forbidden from using libraries. Women were not forbidden from going into a shop and buying ink and paper. Wolfe admired Smythe for her bravery. She praised her as being of the race of pioneers, of pathmakers, who have gone before and felled trees and blasted rocks and built bridges and thus made a way for those who come after her. When Wolfe committed suicide, Smythe was requested to write a tribute to her. She refused, saying, "Later perhaps, but my God, not now." I'd like to be able to tell you that what Smythe called the machine is no longer prohibiting women's music from being heard. Unfortunately, that is not the case. Just last week, an advocacy organization known as the Women's Philharmonic issued a report on the music selected for performance by major American orchestras next season. It found that about 10.5% of the music on orchestral programs will have been composed by women and non-binary composers. But the combined performances of just two composers, Beethoven and Mozart, is just slightly less, three fewer performances, than all of the works by 65 women combined. The Metropolitan Opera is publicizing that they're doing the most new works in the company's modern history, including Kevin Putz's The Hours, based on Wolfe's novel, Mrs. Dalloway. But none of the operas is by a woman. If you would like to read more about Ethel Smythe, I would recommend to you a very brand new book by a wonderful writer, a British writer named Leah Broad. It's a book called Quartet. And it's about not only Ethel, but three other female British composers. It is out in the UK. It is not out in hard copy in the US until September. I think you might be able to get an electronic copy, but I highly recommend Leah's work. Thank you for coming. And if I can see you, I'm happy to take questions. Because there are other places for women to play. There's this, in America in the late 19th and the 20th century, there's this whole world of women's organizations and music clubs at which women often performed. And you'll often hear these clubs referred to as amateur clubs. Well, amateur is only because you didn't get paid, right? It's not because you couldn't play. And some of the clubs even had very steep audition requirements. And if you did not, you know, perform so many times in a certain period, you would get dumped off the A-list and become an associate member, which means you just sat and didn't perform. So there are other places. And being a musician is a hard life. So, you know, it might not be the life you want for your child, whereas marriage to a wealthy man, you know. I mean, yes. But this is also why the women from the middle classes whose families are musicians have careers, and there are lots of them. The upper class women know, or the lower class women know because they're, you know, working in the factory or not getting enough training to be musicians. So again, class is an issue. Linda always asks hard questions.
No, it's following up on that question. It occurred to me that the records of some music schools are like the one at Peter or Juilliard might tell us some interesting things about when the first women students were accepted for advanced training and whether they were always shunted into being music teachers as opposed to performers or
teachers, definitely. I mean, I think one thing we're not aware of in the history of American music, I think America is a little different from Europe, but some of the American conservatories, when they first opened, like the New England Conservatory, were full of women. I've seen the rolls, and it's mostly women and a few men. And in fact, when the Curtis Institute was opened, there were too many women, and they gradually reduced the number of women and upped the number of men because they didn't want, you know, sexism. They didn't want so many women. But if you see the early catalogs of the New England Conservatory, they're sort of these lovely lithographs of people standing around in the hall, and most of them are women. The history of music in America is very tied to women, and we're unaware of that. On the other hand, football players make way more money than musicians, and I think gender has something to do with that. So the athletics department has way more money than the School of Music. So.
I don't know if this is true, but I've just been binging Victoria.
I suspect that's an adventurous script writer. Prince Albert was very much interested in music and subsidized sort of interest in historical music. He was interested in early music. It may have been just, you know, complimentary. There is a very well-known story about Felix Mendelssohn coming to visit Victoria and Albert, and Mendelssohn saying, "Would you sing one of my songs for me?" And she did, and it turned out to be a song by Fanny that had been published in a set of Felix's, and Felix said, "Well, pride must have a fall," and he told her that it was actually his sister's song. So please sing one of mine now, Your Majesty. Famous story.
Before women could access formal training in kind of more public ways, is there evidence of a kind of underground of women training other women in cohorts and?
Well, you can get all the training you want if you can afford it, right? And in America, women in the South, the music teacher would come every day. Women, you know, sort of elite white women. The music teacher could come every day if you would pay him. So it's not a question of learning or playing. It's a question of going out in public and doing it, or getting paid for it, which is, oh my gosh. Women who get paid for things are not the kind of woman you want to be, right?
It strikes me that the position of the woman composer who wants to compose for large groups, like symphonies, is not unlike the position of the choreographer whose vision cannot be acted on without other people to perform it.
Or a playwright.
Or a playwright.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Yes,
and women composers sometimes, you know, published songs by a lady. So that, because it's not respectable to be out in public. It's like being a streetwalker. And also, you know, I think we've also lost the sense about how much class is involved. I mean, I often say to my students, if Bill Gates has a daughter, I have no idea if Bill Gates has a daughter, but if Bill Gates has a daughter, she doesn't work at the local gas station, right? She wouldn't take a job there. There's an 18th century example, it's a little bit earlier, in England, where the music teacher fell in love with the young lady that he was teaching and asked to marry her. And the parents said, yes, you may marry her if you give up being a musician. So that tells you what kind of view people had of being a musician as a career. And we don't think like that now about musicians. We think musicians are great. There are more recordings. Her last work, The Prison, which had never been recorded, has been recorded. You can read the wonderful program notes where Amy Ziegler talks about her the various performances of the records that have taken place over the past few years. So we're in a good moment, and I want to feel optimistic, but I'm a historian. And you know, in 1931, the president of the Clinton Harmonic Society in Clinton, Iowa, they did a women composers program, and she said, well, we used to, you know, not think that women could compose, but now we know better and everything is okay, I'm paraphrasing. And that was 1931, and here we are 100 years later, and I'm giving this talk. I think moving forward, it's you know, we may be in a moment, and then maybe, you know, 20 years from now, things won't be so diverse again. But, you know, I'm not sure 10% is really diverse, or 10.5% is really, you know, it's progress, but it's not enough. Sorry, I'm editorializing. But
so are there other women composers that we should be paying attention to?
Lots. There's an encyclopedia published in the 1980s that was written because somebody said there were no women composers, and it has 5,000 women in it. Now, not all of them are Ethel Smythes or Clara Schumanns or Cecile Chaminades, but 5,000. And you know, the little book that I talked about that had the fourth of the American composers were women. There were women on that book I had never heard of, and I'm supposed to be a college professor who knows these things. So, you know, and some of the music won't be great music, just like a lot of the men composers from the past is not great music, but some of it is. So, places you can hear music by women. There's a YouTube channel called Piano Music She Wrote. If you teach piano and you want pieces for children, they put out performances of women's piano pieces. There's a wonderful scholar in Washington, Oregon, where is Steve? Who has a blog called Art Song Augmented, and he's getting his colleagues to record pieces by women that had never, songs by women that had never been recorded ever. And there are lots of songs that were popular in the sort of 1890s to 1930s that got sung a lot, even by men singing women's music, who knew? That are now forgotten, that I think are certainly revivable for people who are interested. So, and Amy Beach's symphony, the Gaelic Symphony, is not monotonous or spasmodic. I highly recommend it. So yes, there are lots and lots of recordings out there, and I'm sure you will find somebody you like.
You mentioned the
Esther building
in
1906
or so.
1904, yeah.
And there was a woman's club.
Yes.
So do you think progress has been made? In my lifetime, which started in the 40s, there were women were in bands, and they played clarinet, and men played brass, and things like that, and women played violin, I mean, girl students. What kind of progress has been made? It looks like yours, about half of them.
Yes, lots of progress has been made.
Is Taylor Swift a composer?
I don't know. She writes music, doesn't she?
Yeah.
And she makes more money than I do.
Because the music that
no.
No.
But women have made all kinds of music. So. Songs and symphonies. I'm getting the signal from Megan that we need to finish up. So thank you so much for coming.